their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Monday, June 23rd, 2025. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Matt Duss, Executive Vice President at the Center for International Policy and co-host of the Undiplomatic Pod on America's attack on Iran, also on the program to discuss that attack, Eskander Sagadi Burjerdi, senior lecturer in history in the Middle East at the University of York in the UK. Then Anthony Conright, writer, discussing his piece in The Nation, Will Black Americans Vote for a Socialist, Zoran Mamdani. Meanwhile, U.S. enters Israel's war, bombing Iran, and yet Trump officials admit they have no idea if it successfully destroyed Iran's nuclear sites. Meanwhile, Israel continues to turn Gaza aid sites into a killing field. In New York City, mayoral election is tomorrow, and Mamdani catches Cuomo in the latest Emerson poll. Trump's beautiful disaster bill polling is in the toilet as the Senate races to pass it, and the parliamentarian strips out nearly a dozen of its provisions. Judge denies government motion to hold Abrega Garcia. ICE, however, is looking to detain Garcia as soon as he's released. Mahmoud Khalil is released on conditioned bail. And NATO to meet tomorrow in the wake of being in the dark on the U.S. attack on Iran. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks so much for joining us. Emma on honeymoon. We were going to have a special guest co-host for the day, but he missed his plane last night from California. Yep. Kids today. Can never get anywhere on time. But
this is why you guys don't get invited places.
Hopefully we will have Hassan Piker on the show next time he's in New York. Or he's probably flying in this morning. So we'll see. I don't know. We got a lot to get to today. Obviously, our schedule has been completely upended because of the attack on Iran this weekend. We had Adam Gaffney scheduled for today to talk about the Medicaid provisions in the so-called Big Beautiful Bill. We will have him on Friday to discuss those. In the meantime, this poll showing Zoran Mamdani up is fascinating and exciting. Tomorrow is the election. You have seen every Democratic establishment figure there is, the old ones, come out in support of Cuomo. I'm talking about Bill Clinton. I don't know if these two guys met at some type of sexual harassers support group or what. I don't know. Clinton came out in favor of Cuomo. Clyburn the other day came out in favor of Cuomo, but Cuomo has a problem, and that is that the enthusiasm is with Mamdani, and that is a bigger issue in a primary than it would be in a general election. In a general election, people just go out and vote because they know about the election. It's in the news constantly. They don't want a Republican to win. In a primary, enthusiasm can take you a far way, even if you're fighting against literally tens of millions of dollars poured into the race by people like Mike Bloomberg and Ken Langone's folks and Palantir, all of these right wingers.
DoorDash.
DoorDash. They're all funding Andrew Cuomo. This poll came out. You can see this is the New York Democratic primary tracking. This is from Emerson Polling, along with Pix 11, a local station in The Hill. Andrew Cuomo leading Mamdani 35% to 32%. And look at those trajectories. Mamdani gained 10 points on the initial ballot test, rising from 22% to 32%. That's relative to Emerson's last month's poll, while Cuomo gained 1 point, 34% to 35%. And this polling was done over the weekend. Yes, I believe it was over the weekend. The ranked choice voting simulation over eight rounds ends with Mamdani at 52% and Cuomo at 48%. Voters who have already cast their ballots during New York City's early voting period break for Mamdani. Again, this is they did a poll. I think it was like 850 people. There's a 3 or 4% margin of error. Many of the people that they contacted had already voted, or at least some. Mamdani held a 10-point lead over Cuomo, 41 to 31% on early voters. Among those who planned to vote on Election Day or had not yet voted at the time of the survey, Cuomo leads with 36%, followed by Mamdani at 31%. We got some images to show you as to why this is very, very problematic for Cuomo. Right now, it's like 95 degrees in New York City. I walked to work 3 hours ago and was sweating my buttocks off. And folks know I'm old, but I'm spry. Voters under 50 break for Mamdani by a 2-to-1 margin. Cuomo leads 50 to 59-year-olds, 63 to 37%, because my cohort of voters are the worst people in the country. We were raised in the Reagan era. PJ O'Rourke and he was on Spin City and the Family Ties. Michael J. Fox was like a little right winger, and we all, fortunately for me, I escaped by just wearing sweater vests, and I didn't adopt anything else. Hispanic voters support Cuomo 60 to 40%. Black voters favor Cuomo 62 to 38%. We're going to talk to Anthony Conright about that later. Asian voters 79 to 21%. Mamdani leads Cuomo among college-educated voters 62 to 38%. This survey was taken from the 18th to the 20th, so there was still a couple of days of early voting left. And here is why. This is a shot on... was it on Sunday? Is this on Sunday? This is from yesterday. that was the last day of early voting. Sunday. Today's Monday. Okay. Last day of early voting at the Museum of Natural History. And this is why Andrew Cuomo has a problem with having to rely so heavily on Election Day voting. First of all, you have Mamdani beating Cuomo 2-to-1 with voters who are under the age of 50. Speaking as someone who is over the age of 50, I can tell you my sensitivity to heat has grown exponentially each year into my 50s. Here is what the line looked like outside of the Museum of Natural History on the final day of early voting. Now, I don't know how long people are waiting in that line, but I can tell you, they're not going to wait that long if it's 100 degrees out in New York City.
And I don't think they're all shaded by scaffolding like that.
Exactly. So, obviously, look, so much about this is predicting, you know, who's going to come out to vote. If you watched the, if you've watched any television in New York City for the past 4 weeks, you have been inundated with negative Mamdani ads. The Cuomo people have gone completely berserk. They have so much money to pour out the door. But it's also an incompetent campaign that failed to get their matching funds. So if you haven't voted in New York City and you are a New York City voter, understand your vote tomorrow is going to be even more heavily weighted insofar as your ability to get out and vote. It's probably going to be offsetting multiple votes on the other side. People who intended to vote for Cuomo, but give up because it's too hot. So this is a big, big deal. It's a big deal. Go back and look at the press after Adams won in 2024. He was considered, I'm sorry, 2022. He was considered to be, Nate Silver said he was like one of his top choices to be a presidential candidate. I'm not saying that Mamdani is going to do that, but traditionally, something like this has very, very big impact nationally. So there you go. It's exciting stuff. Here is a video of an elderly man speaking about Andrew Cuomo. Do we have that one? Just to inspire you. Go ahead.
That he's a fucking asshole. I was one of the people that, you know, unfortunately was here when he was sticking people in here that had COVID, and they were side by side with us instead of them, you know, being on their own unit, people getting coughing and other people getting infected and with that shit, and led to a lot of people dying, a lot of people getting sick. I even got sick. You know, it was bodies being carried out of here left and right while they complimenting this man on doing a good job when he actually did a fucked up job. He fucked up a lot of people's life. He took a lot of lives away because of that shit. They wasn't planned for that shit right. And he could have prevented a lot of things from happening the way that it did, especially in here. If I could say something to the next mayor in New York, I would tell him not to do the same dumb shit that Cuomo did to us during COVID, and to take heed and realize that people in nursing homes matter and treat us better.
Anything else you want to share?
Fuck Cuomo.
What do you wish?
There you go. Appreciate the sentiment. We'll probably get demonetized because of that, but that was worth
money well spent.
Exactly. Happy to services in kind. In a moment, we'll be talking to Matt Duss, president at the Center for the International Policy, executive vice president at the Center for International Policy, co-host of the Undiplomatic Pod. It is super hot in this city. My air conditioning always at home underperforms. It has for ages. It's a long story. I don't want to get into it too much. But the beauty is I've got fans. And then on top of that, I sleep on temperature regulating sheets. It's Cozy Earth's bamboo sheets. They temperature regulate. They are guaranteed to give you a comfortable night's sleep. They naturally wick away heat and moisture from your body, helping you sleep several degrees cooler. I have done an actual, not a taste test. I've compared non-Cozier sheets with Cozier sheets, and they actually work. Plus, they got all sorts of other things. I've got an amazing jogger from them. My favorite hoodie is from Cozy Earth. It is both, like, heavy but cool, warm when you need it to be. They have something called the all-day tee, and I will tell you that it's not just an all-day tee. It is actually a twice-day tee. Because over the weekend, I'm like, who am I going to see? Why am I going to wash this? It's naturally breathable fabric. Keeps you cool and comfortable all day. They have a new line of pants called Studio Pants. They're incredibly soft. They are super comfortable and breathable. They feel like you're wearing sweats, but they look like nice pants. I want to thank Cozy Earth for sponsoring this episode. Cozy Earth understands we need to create our home sanctuary. Your 5-to-9 routine should include relaxation and rejuvenation and cooling down. Cozy Earth bedding products have a 10-year warranty that is a decade of cool quality sleep. They have a 100-night sleep trial. You try them during the hottest nights of the year. That's now. If you're not in love, return them hassle-free, but believe me, you will not want to. Luxury shouldn't be out of reach. Go to CozyEarth.com. Use the code MajorityReport, all one word, for up to 40% off of Cozy Earth best-selling temperature-regulating sheets, apparel, and more. Trust me, you're going to feel the difference the very first night. That's CozyEarth.com. Code is MajorityReport. Sleep cooler, lounge lighter, stay cozy. Also, this time of year, I've got a shift from red wine to white wine. Or maybe to a rosé, because I feel like it triggers my eczema. I don't know why I'm spending so much time. Everything is now eczema-oriented. But when I go into a wine store, or at least back in the day, I'm like, I have no idea what wine to get. And then if somebody comes up to me and starts talking about fruity or nutty, or you can, you know, volcanic ash or whatever, I can't. I don't know what to pick. At a wine store. However, I have now been able to bypass that entire process. If you ever wanted to learn about wine but can't figure it out, our next partner, Naked Wines, has changed the game for learning about wine. You don't have to take a class. You just basically save a lot of money. Today's episode is sponsored by Naked Wines. It's 2025. You don't want to shop for wine like it was 2005. Naked Wines is a service that directly connects you to the world's finest independent winemakers so you can get award-winning wine delivered straight to your door. And if you use our code MAJORITY for the code and password at nakedwines.com, you will be able to get their incredible deal of 6 bottles of wine for just $39.99. I've talked in the past how my sister Julie used to work for winemakers in Italy. She has incredibly high standards. Will denigrate the vast majority of things in the past, of wines I have bought in the past. We got a bunch of wines for Thanksgiving and for Passover this year. Because we're all together. And she gave it a big thumbs up. I have a great Syrah from Naked Wines. They have been around for over 15 years. They fund 90 independent winemakers around the world. There are no commitments or membership fees. You can enjoy Naked Wines hassle-free. You can pause or cancel at any time. If you got a trip coming up or you just backed up, you can enjoy Naked Wines after that period easily. Now is the time to join the Naked Wines community. Head to nakedwines.com/majority. Click enter voucher. Put in the code majority for both the code and the password for 6 bottles of wine for just $39.99, shipping included. That's $100 off your first 6 bottles at nakedwines.com/majority. Use the code and password majority for 6 bottles of wine for $39.99. We'll put the all of that info in the podcast and YouTube description. Quick break, and then Matt Duss. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Emma Vigeland out this week. Want to welcome back to the program Executive Vice President, the Center for International Policy, co-host of the Undiplomatic Pod, Matt Duss. Matt, we've talked in the past about the potential for something like this. Give me your sense of how surprised were you? I mean, if you go back even like 3 weeks ago, that the U.S. would attack the Iranians.
As of 3 weeks ago, even just over a week ago, I mean, just up until the moment the news broke of Israel launching its attacks, it was two Thursdays ago. It seemed that, you know, diplomacy was moving along and we could get a deal. I mean, there were clearly some gaps. You know, Trump seems to have landed on this in you know, demand for zero enrichment in Iran, which I think most people understand is a non-starter. And unfortunately, I think a lot of the people who are pushing him to make that a demand understand it's a non-starter because they intended it as a poison pill for the negotiations. But Stephen, it still seemed to me that, you know, Witkoff was committed to it. The Iranians and Americans were talking to each other, which is good to be able to kind of narrow those gaps. But then, you know, once Israel attacked, and it's the reporting started to come out about how Trump eventually went along with that, even if it wasn't a bright green light, it was enough of a yellowish light that Netanyahu went ahead and did what he did, making an enormous bet that Trump would eventually join in. And it seemed likely that given that Trump had sort of folded under pressure to support what Israel was doing, he would eventually fold and do what he did Saturday night.
Well, just to go back for just a moment in terms of like Trump's demands in the context of negotiations, were there other ones? I mean, I remember the original in the original JPOCA or I am
JCPOA. Yeah.
Yes.
Almost. Yeah.
I was close. that the biggest sort of like complaints of the neoconservatives was that this was just a deal about nuclear proliferation, as opposed to getting Iran to stop funding their proxy organizations, to a whole host of issues that they had. Was that included in the asks by the Trump administration?
Not to my knowledge. And you're right. That was one of the complaints that neocons had, was that this non-proliferation agreement didn't deal with things that aren't non-proliferation. But Trump, you know, as far as I know, yes. I mean, I'm sure these things were being discussed, you know, Iran's ballistic missiles and support for proxies, you know, extremist groups around the region. But this was still pretty focused on the nuclear program, as far as I know.
My understanding is we don't really have a sense of what the how effective the U.S. was at ending Iran's nuclear program. Have you heard anything to that effect?
I mean, I think we can say quite definitively that the United States and Israel have not ended Iran's nuclear program. I think just starting with satellite photos, you can see that there's damage done to the Fordo facility. Unsurprisingly, it dropped, you know, B-2 bombers dropped, I think, the biggest non-nuclear weapon that the United States has several times on this mountain facility. But still, it's a big mountain and stuff is inside hardened bunkers deep under that mountain. If I would encourage folks to look at Jeffrey Lewis, he's an analyst at the Monterey Institute. The Middlebury Institute in Monterey, California. He had a long tweet thread based on a piece he'd written where he says, you know, tactically, yes, this stuff's impressive, but this has at best, as far as we can tell right now, set back Iran's program several months. Again, it's hard to say for sure because Iran, from what I've heard, concluded that Trump was going to do this. They concluded this a couple weeks ago. So they started transferring material to different places. There are, you know, Fordo is kind of the big facility that people do know about. Everyone has long estimated there are facilities we don't know about. And Iran had told the IAEA that at some point it was going to open a new enrichment facility. And you can bet when they announced that facility, they would not be just like breaking ground for it on that day. It would be something that they had essentially already created. So, yeah, it seems from the estimates I'm seeing, these attacks, this war, this grave violation of international law has managed to set back Iran's nuclear program a fraction of what the JCPOA did.
I want to try and dig in a little bit more into, like, you know, what the goal here is, and why Trump did this. But let's start with Israel, because it seems to me that Israel has at one point, and I don't know how many months ago it was, planned for this in the sense that they take out Hezbollah. They go deep into Syria. They attempt to degrade Yemen's capacity. Obviously, they, after the 4-week truce in Gaza, they went on to further decimate, and now, like, you know, a full-on starvation campaign, essentially, with the Palestinians there. But Iran's capacity to strike back seems to me has been diminished. I don't know how much, but certainly it's been diminished insofar as, like, if Hezbollah still had its capacity, they would be sending rockets into northern Israel by now. If Hamas had its capacity, they'd be sending rockets into southern Israel by now. If Yemen had increased capacity, they would also, I mean, I imagine that they have a little bit in the wake of the bombing campaign that Israel started against Iran a week or two ago. But it seems like Israel has been planning this, and that this is more about regime change than anything else. I mean, because it's clear, even the U.S. did not, you know, this is not like a quick one and done type of situation.
Right. No, I mean, there's a couple things there. One is, first, the last part first is, yes, at this point, it seems very, very clear that Israel's goal is regime change. I mean, it's bombing schools, it's bombing police stations, it bombed the gates of Evin prison just a few hours ago, a notorious prison where a lot of dissidents and activists are taken and often tortured by the regime. So it's bombing symbols of the regime. It's not just bombing nuclear facilities. And I think that's ultimately what they want to try and draw Donald Trump into. And if his, you know, if he's going to try, if he just wants to do this one and done strike, which, again, I wish he hadn't done it, but now that he's done it, I hope that's what it is. That's obviously a much bigger proposition. And the idea that anyone thinks that this will turn out well just boggles my mind. But now we have to go back, and what you talked about, you know, over the course of, you know, the past, whatever it is, 20 months since October 7, you'll notice that Israel steadily, you know, started acting much in a much more escalatory fashion wherever it wanted, whether, you know, obviously obliterating Gaza and then, you know, taking action in Lebanon and then Syria as well. Once the Assad regime fell, you know, it's occupying parts of Syria right now. It has bombed Yemen. And again, it has genuine concerns with Hezbollah, with the Houthis. Syria, it's much, much less clear. But now, you know, again, having weakened Iran's partners in exactly the way you said, and kind of what Iran used to have, what is known as strategic depth. I mean, that was the goal of forming all these relationships and supporting these groups across the region, was just to have different levers that they could pull, you know, and, you know, as a deterrent to keep Israel or the United States or anyone else from doing what is happening now, that those levers have been degraded. But it seems that if you want to, like, apply a strategy to what Israel has been doing, and in part, it's hard to apply a strategy because, let's also remember, a lot of this, as we have discussed before, is driven by Netanyahu's own political imperatives. I mean, he needs to keep this war going to stay out of jail, essentially. But if we want to see a pattern here, and this is what we're, you know, if not toppling the regime, at least severely weakening the regime in Iran makes sense, because that's kind of what Israel and some in the United States want to see. Just a severely degraded region, if not collapsed states, then very weak states, that, you know, the United States and by proxy, the United States, you know, local sheriff, Israel in this case, can kind of exert power.
What? I mean, this seems like a huge risk to me from Donald Trump's perspective. Mm-hmm. What do you think is actually driving this? I mean, they were 60 days is not that long to have a deadline for these negotiations. That seems absurd to me. Yes. Donald Trump wanted to be, you know, is portraying himself as a peacemaker. He already made his deals to get money from Miriam Adelson, and it didn't include backing up Israel's regime change. What is your sense that is actually driving this? Is it just he's got people? I mean, he specifically left Hegseth out. Mm-hmm. He specifically is ignoring all the intelligence that says this is not an ongoing threat.
Yes, right.
What is their thinking?
I mean, with Trump, you know, it could be just very simple that, you know, enough people got into his ear and convinced him to change course. I think part of what I've heard is that Netanyahu and others were working on him really hard, saying the Iranians are taking you for a ride. They're treating you like a sucker. They're not negotiating in good faith. Listen, we saw how effective Netanyahu was at manipulating, you know, Joe Biden and Joe Biden's team. He's done this with a number of presidents. Again, that's not to absolve the U.S. of our very clear responsibility not to get suckered into this stuff by Netanyahu. But he's really good at working the U.S. bureaucracy. And he certainly has allies within the administration. There was an ongoing debate between the administration's hawks and the more administration's more restraint committed folks. People like J.D. Vance, my understanding is that Hegseth himself had been more on that side. Obviously, Tulsi Gabbard, the director of national intelligence, who most recently put out that assessment that you're talking about, that the U.S. intelligence community continues to assess that Iran has not made a decision to obtain a nuclear weapon. So, you know, I think Trump obviously was convinced to go ahead and yellowish green light the Israeli attack. And from what I've read, and I find this convincing, is that popped off. And he spent the night watching Fox News, hailing this, all the, you know, the footage of this impressive stuff that the Israelis can do. And they can do some really impressive stuff. And, you know, when the initial news of the attack broke, you saw the statement from Secretary Rubio saying, oh, well, Israel's doing this. We're not part of it. This is, they've taken these steps on their own. But by the morning, Trump puts out a Truth Social post, you know, clearly trying to associate him more with the war, saying, oh, yes, it's just, you know, just wonderful, and trying to take some credit for it. So I think he's unfortunately just been convinced that this is how you do MAGA.
Let me ask you about this, and this is complete speculation and conjecture in my life, because it seems like, I mean, I give very little credit to Donald Trump as a thinker in any way, but one thing that he does have a sense of is like his own protecting his own political hide.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's hard for me to imagine what the upside is for him on this. But I wonder, you know, Saudi Arabia has been so quiet relative to, it's like, you know, what was a very heated proxy war up until, I feel like, a year ago, maybe, you know, less. And, you know, as late as like, you know, a year or 2 years ago, it seemed that everything that was happening in the Middle East was a function in some way of this war, proxy war between Iran and Saudi Arabia. To what extent do you think there is, you know, the interests of those Gulf states maybe sitting back, also encouraging Trump in a very, very quiet way to do something like this? I mean, this is clearly picking up from the neocon vision that started in the Iraq war.
Yep.
Like, we're going to go to Iraq, then we're going to go to Syria, then we're going to go to Iran, and the Middle East is going to be basically like Disneyland with democracy. And I wonder if that dream wasn't revived less from an ideological standpoint in Donald Trump's mind, but in terms of there's a lot of money for me here, and it's worth a lot to the Saudis for me to engage in this.
Well, that's just it. He was getting that money anyway. And you're right, up until a few years ago, especially during the era of the JCPOA, when Obama was trying to make a deal with the Iranians, there was strong opposition from the Saudis, from the Emiratis, and obviously from the Israelis. But let's remember, a few years ago, there was a Saudi-Iran detente that was brokered by China. Mohammed bin Salman, you know, well, obviously have a lot of problems with him. He's actually been trying to have better relations with Iran. You know, he's been trying to have better relations with a lot of actors in the region. They've basically squashed the beef with Qatar. So, you know, while I'm not going to say that they're displeased at Iran, at, you know, the Iranian government taking a beating, I don't think this is something that the Saudis were really strongly advocating, because they're kind of getting what they want from Donald Trump anyway. And so to have the Israelis and the Americans now coming behind them, just, you know, unilaterally going in and smashing up Tehran, another major Middle Eastern capital, that's not something that really sits well with the region's publics. And Mohammed bin Salman and some of these other leaders are conscious that of public opinion.
Interesting. And so give me your, I mean, it's anybody's guess what happens next. But I guess it has to do with the likelihood of Iran retaliating. And then it feels like it could be off to the races. What is your sense?
Right. I mean, so what we're seeing today, I mean, there was a few hours ago, there was news that the Qatari government had urged Americans in the countries to shelter in place. Always a great phrase that means trouble is on the way. They've closed Qatari airspace. I don't know if this indicates that Iran could be striking El Udeid base, which is the U.S.'s biggest base in the Middle East. They're just outside Doha, Qatar. We did see, I mean, my sense is even before Trump attacked, I mean, Iran was signaling that they want to de-escalate. They did not want the U.S. to get involved, and they're ready to de-escalate, but they were not ready to negotiate peace while Israel was still attacking them, understandably. But let's think back to, you know, January 2020, when Trump assassinated Qasem Soleimani, the head of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard's Quds Force and kind of Iran's like regional mastermind and planner for all of Iran's kind of proxy groups. Iran responded with an hours long. First of all, it signaled that it was going to respond. It needed to respond. But this response would be a one-off. They did not want to escalate further. But then they launched an hours-long missile attack against al-Assad base in Iraq that nearly killed 150 U.S. troops who were there sheltering in these bunkers as this attack went on. And then it came out slowly, little by little, that over 100 of them had sustained traumatic brain injuries. Now, Trump himself, it was very interesting. Like they initially denied that there were any casualties. And then little by little, they started to say, okay, a few people were hurt. And then it finally came out, no, 100 were pretty severely injured. But that signaled that Trump understood, okay, I want this to de-escalate too. And if it immediately comes out rather than in dribs and drabs of that there were actual serious casualties, it could create political pressure on me to have to escalate. I mean, so that does indicate a level of political intelligence, or at least understanding, like I could be pushed into something that I don't want to do. I hope that there will be something similar that happens now.
I hope you're right. Matt Duss, I have a feeling we'll probably be in touch over the coming weeks. Really appreciate your insights here and analysis. We will link to the Center for International Policy and your diplomatic pod.
Thanks a lot, Sam.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking to senior lecturer in the history of the Middle East at the University of York, Skander Sagadi Borgiardi, just after this. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. Emma Vigeland off this week. I want to welcome to the program Senior Lecturer in History of the Middle East at the University of York, Iskander Asadeghi. Iskander, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Great to be with you.
Let's start from the your sense of the forces that led to, I mean, I think like the Israeli sort of desire to attack Iran has been in existence for my entire adult life, as far as I can tell, from like the, you know, Netanyahu's been talking about this for 30 years. Do you have a sense of what the other players in the region, like what their perspective is on this and what might be inspiring Trump and the forces that may be sort of acting upon that? Because I know you have a piece today in the Jacobin about the Shah's son.
Well, I think the Shah's son, which we can get to in a little bit, is more of a, actually a useful idiot and like a propaganda tool, which is basically being used by the Israelis very somewhat effectively, I guess, but not all too effectively. Obviously, there's a grander kind of, I think, geopolitical agenda at work. Obviously, this animosity and hostility to Iran has really defined Benjamin Netanyahu's entire sort of political career. I mean, from the mid-90s, he's been harping on about the imminent threat posed by Iran's nuclear program. So much so that actually even an Israeli scholar, a scholar by the name of Hagar Ram, wrote a very good book called Iranophobia, in which he kind of explored how Iran really was a way in which Israeli elites managed to deflect from sort of neoliberalism, neoliberalization in Israeli society, so many of the contradictions defining Israeli society. Iran has sort of been this perpetual boogeyman, I think, and sort of presented as this existential threat. And of course, you know, Iran has this history, a long history going back to the revolution of 1979, obviously supporting the Palestinian cause. Obviously, it defines itself, the Islamic Republic defines itself against sort of American hegemony and Israeli kind of dominance in the region. And I guess we're sort of seeing this, sort of this long arc of various regimes which have been ousted or overthrown, many of which were obviously seen as posed threats, I guess, to Israeli domination of the region. And Iran was always seen as sort of the final sort of obstacle, the final sort of country to take out in this long list that famously Wesley Clark spoke about as well, General Wesley Clark spoke about. So I think this is sort of, you know, he saw this as his opportunity, really, in order to force the issue. My sense is, I mean, again, and we really don't know the granular detail, of course, but my sense is that you know, there had been extensive sort of intelligence sharing between the Israelis and obviously the American government, you know, the Pentagon and so on. I'm pretty sure, you know, that had been shared for some time. And I think it was a matter of timing, really. And I think obviously following the fall of Assad, there was, I mean, I'm sure you heard this for the last couple of months that, you know, Iran is the weakest ever been. Now is the time. And I think obviously he forced the issue, but he also managed, I think, convince Donald Trump. And I think, you know, they both have different objectives. I think Donald Trump's objective was to use the Israeli attacks, one, to weaken Iran further, and then obviously maybe pursue this attack on Iran's nuclear sites, but also potentially use it as leverage, not to negotiate, because I wouldn't call this a negotiation, to impose what he called, quote unquote, you know, total surrender. So that's, I think, sort of the lay of the land in the sort of grander scheme of things.
Will you just remind people, because in this country, history usually only goes back about 3 years. In the context of Iran, it's as if nothing existed prior to 1979. But will you just, for folks who don't know, reiterate the history going back to 1953 or 1950, when Mossadegh was ousted in a CIA and, as far as I know, MI6 coup. Will you just give us a little bit of that history?
I mean, I think that is a good place to start, absolutely. But I think I won't really go on a long digression, but we could even go back to sort of 1907 when Iran was basically de facto divided into different spheres of influence by Imperial Russia and Britain, where you have the establishment of BP, you know, well, it was called the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company at the time. It was basically an enclave which was completely controlled by the British, even we had its own sort of security services. Then you can even move to 1941, where Britain, and again, this time the Soviet Union, basically invaded Iran and occupied it. Then, of course, we can move to 1953, where in 1951, sort of the nationalist premier, Mohammad Mossadegh, had decided with a lot of sort of a popular mandate, really, and a lot of popular support to nationalize the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, which is today known as BP, British Petroleum. And of course, you know, he was immediately sort of faced with a naval blockade by the British. And then you had ultimately the Eisenhower administration and Churchill government here in the UK plot for his overthrow. And then he is ultimately obviously overthrown by the MI6 and the CIA. And then subsequently after that, the Shah returns from Rome. And then we have really this steady building up and consolidation of his dictatorship. And obviously, the United States, the CIA, as well as the Mossad, actually, the Israelis, had a very, very decisive role, actually, in building up the infamous Savak, which tortured and executed many, many dissidents in Iran during this period. And that was the source of, you know, this growing enmity, because obviously they had, you know, very much the United States was seen as sort of supporting the Shah throughout this period in a very kind of uncritical way. I mean, we can even go to sort of 1976, where, you know, the Shah was really buying more American arms per capita than any other power in the world. And maybe even in absolute terms at that point, he was the biggest purchaser of American arms. That's why he was sort of given so much leeway. And he became known as the gendarme of the Persian Gulf, sort of very much carrying out within this broader kind of American hegemonic security architecture, sort of very much aligned with broader American objectives in the Persian Gulf region. And Saudi Arabia at that time was more of a junior partner, actually. Obviously, this is sort of, you know, and in 1975, he established a one-party state as well. So that's another kind of feather in his cap. And then, of course, he's overthrown in the revolution, which runs between 1977 and 1979, which obviously brought the Islamic Republic ultimately to power.
The Islamic Republic, what was the revolution that took place in 79? How much of it was a function of there were pro-democratic forces? There was, I was young at the time, so I don't remember the details. But there were multiple sort of like cohorts that were involved in that revolution. It was that the Khomeini cohort had the most sort of like power, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the revolution was a broad coalition. It sort of ran from liberal nationalists to kind of more religiously inclined sort of nationalists, to Marxist-Leninists, to Maoists, to obviously Islamists as well, but also of various hues. Some that were more influenced actually by sort of Marxian sort of ideology, some that were closer to the clergy and sort of the commercial classes, the mercantile kind of classes, the bazaar. And obviously, I mean, Khomeini was very clearly kind of the unparalleled and undisputed, I think, leader of the revolution. I guess not many Iranians necessarily envisioned the constitution that would ultimately emerge in the power struggle to define the post-revolutionary state, however.
I'm starting to see some reports on our IM, and I don't know that there it's possible that there was an attack on that U.S. base in Qatar that Matt Duss had just told us some people were saying was imminent. What is your sense of the potential of this being one round of tit for tat as it comes in terms of like in terms of America, and that's it?
I mean, I'm sure that both maybe the Trump administration, or I have a set, I think to, up to a point that is how maybe the Trump administration has envisioned it, and I also probably think that the Iranians similarly hope for that to be the case. But the problem with these things is that they have a kind of a life of their own, and it's usually where you know, the sort of unpredictable factor which sort of enters in, where this could spiral. I think that's always been the fear. I mean, obviously, a lot of people are referring back to the, you know, when Qasem Soleimani, General Qasem Soleimani, was assassinated by the Trump administration in Iraq, again on a sort of a ruse, sort of luring him there for negotiations actually with Saudi Arabia, and then he was killed in a third country. And then in retaliation for that, Iran struck, basically telegraphed ahead to the Americans to empty out the Ain al-Assad airbase, which they did, and that sort of controlled it. And I guess maybe that has happened. Obviously, I don't have any information in that regard, but I would assume that that is a possibility, that maybe similarly, because I did gather that already the Qataris have closed their airspace. So yes. And obviously Qatar is a, I mean, it's on the one hand, it's a close ally of the United States and hosts, you know, CENTCOM, and it's sort of the biggest airbase in the region, but it is also a friend of the Iranian government as well. It's, you know, they have cordial relations. So I could imagine Iran basically giving them a heads up, and that's why we saw that. So that would make sense to me. That seems plausible.
I mean, if you Google Iran bombs Qatar, you can see reports as early as 2, 3, 4, or 5 hours ago that it was imminent, which right, yeah. seems to me to be a sufficient amount of time for at least the people on that base to either evacuate or get into shelters or whatever it is that they would do. That doesn't yeah. seem like an exactly like a surprise attack, as it were.
No. I mean, just one thing that I would just add that I think is important. I mean, you have to really understand that Iran, from the outset, since the Israeli act of aggression in violation of Article 51 of the UN Charter, Iran has actually consistently been indicating both to the Gulf states that it doesn't want to target them, or it doesn't want this to expand and get any worse. So they have been, because they don't want to alienate the Gulf states, and they've actually been trying to indicate that it's the Israelis in particular. And obviously, following obviously the American attack, the Americans obviously very much have a hand in this and are seen as a co-belligerent. I mean, I guess they already were even before this, but they've been trying to indicate that, and trying to show that the Israelis are the key sort of agents of instability, the true sort of agents of chaos. And this is why they've very much been sort of appealing to the UN, appealing to the UN Charter, appealing to their Gulf allies. But I think obviously the strikes on Iran's nuclear sites by the United States was this one, you know, it was obviously just a red line which just couldn't be allowed to be passed without some response.
What is your sense in terms of the stability of the Iranian regime, and what Do you have any sense of, like, in the event that it was to sort of become shakier, what entities might take over, and where would their sympathies be?
I mean, my sense, at least for the time being, is that there has been a sort of a rallying around the flag or a rallying around the homeland effect. I mean, this has been remarkable. I've remarked on it, like, you know, at the very outset. I've seen scenes which are, you know, which really are reminiscent of the 1980s in Iran, when basically, obviously, the United States backed Saddam Hussein's invasion, more or less, of Iran in support of that war effort for 8 years. So, I mean, I have seen a fair degree of resilience. Obviously, the Iranian state is very unpopular in some quarters. It does, however, have a deep base of support. I mean, we need to understand, I mean, it came about through a revolution and then was basically institutionalized and forged in a war. I mean, the people in the Revolutionary Guards basically fought for an 8-year period, and they saw, you know, they fought in sort of World War I style trenches. The idea that they're just going to melt away, I think, is for the birds, to be honest with you. And I do think it is resilient. And I think actually, I mean, the things that I'm seeing, and I try to follow their official channels and see what their kind of discourse is. I'm not obviously endorsing that, but I'm trying to get a sense of what they're thinking. From what I gather, they're ready for a longer campaign. I mean, I think, and from what I understand, I mean, maybe this was a symbolic strike at this American airbase, but from what I gather, they actually want to draw this out with respect to strikes on the Israelis, because I think their main fear actually is that Netanyahu then goes back to his public, you know, with like this sort of sense of triumphalism. And then potentially moves to try and normalize strikes on Iran. So I think they are actually going to continue to sort of work out the weaknesses and vulnerabilities in Israel's air defenses. And I think, you know, there is a good chance that they will try to continue that because, you know, Netanyahu's promise is that this is going to be a quick lightning campaign and we're going to be triumphant. And actually, you know, the greatest fear, and you also see this amongst Israeli sort of security analysts and so on. I mean, one of their greatest fears is that this drawn out, that this gets drawn out for weeks. So I think actually they're kind of revving up for that. But yeah, I mean, you know, the Iranian state itself has multiple vulnerabilities, of course. There was a lot of discontent. There's been protests, both over the economy, both over the conditions, the political conditions, over the state in which women have often been treated. You know, there's been lots of protests in that regard and discontent. But again, I mean, in conditions of war, what happens is society tends to get militarized, nationalist fervor. You know, it's very predictable. I mean, if you spoke to me beforehand, I could have easily predicted this. I think many, many experts have also said that this would actually happen. And this is really kind of detrimental, I think. If we support, you know, struggles for greater sort of democratic rights and civil rights and labor rights, you know, sort of a highly militarized society is not going to be conducive to that, obviously.
I am skeptical as to that's what our support really is. I mean, I would imagine to the extent that the United States and Israel have a desire for regime change in Iran, it is for some version of the Shah again.
No. I absolutely agree with you there. I meant sort of us who people of good conscience, maybe.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. I mean, I wrote very kind of, I mean, to be honest, just the sheer brazenness, actually. I do think the Israelis and their understanding of Iran is just untethered from reality. I think on the one hand, they're fed stuff maybe by the parts and elements within the sort of monarchist Iranian diaspora. And on the other hand, I mean, maybe their own expertise. And also, I just felt, you know, the fact of the matter is that they've sort of had this the sense of impunity ongoing for many, many years. But obviously, it's intensified since sort of the genocide in Gaza has been carrying on unabated. So there is this kind of sense of imperviousness and invincibility. And within days, actually, of the strikes, the Jerusalem Post was outright calling for the balkanization of Iran, which immediately circulated on Iranian Twitter and social media. And I mean, even people who really do not like this regime, which is, you know, are horrified, and they really have no trust or no faith whatsoever in either the Americans or the Israelis. And they really, and of course, they see what's happened in Libya and in Syria, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and they understand that I think the United States and the Israelis would prefer a really fragmented, shattered sort of state without any real capacity and ability to function. Than actually a strong functioning state. And I think they understand that. And that's why we see the reactions across much of Iranian civil society that we have.
I think it's hard for people to appreciate how incompetent in terms of making these assessments the Israelis can be and frankly, the U.S. can be. I mean, we saw this with Iraq. People were convinced that Iraq was going to, you know, within months, blossom into some type of free market paradise and society would be and things would function. And we watched 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 years of total incompetence in the form of the coalition provisional authority. Maybe it was a little bit longer, but it was shocking the level of assuredness that the so-called experts had. And I think it's like, you know, as just citizens, we presume like, oh, we may disagree with the idea of, you know, attacking and bombing another country. But these people must know what they're talking about on some level, even if we disagree what they're doing. But their assessments can be completely, totally blinkered.
Well, just to speak to that, I mean, I'm not sure if you've seen the latest New York Times reporting, but it basically says that they don't even know where the stockpile of highly enriched uranium is. And there's plenty of actually evidence that, I mean, they're claiming that Iran's centrifuges have all been destroyed. But I mean, I wouldn't bet on that. So on the one hand, what the Trump administration has done really untold damage to the nuclear non-proliferation regime, like really damage beyond measure. They've shown it to be absolutely kind of hypocritical, have a double standard. I mean, Iran was, it was the most inspected place on the planet. And obviously previously subjected itself to the JCPOA in 2015, as we know, the deal which Mr. Trump trashed. And then what we have is a scenario whereby two nuclear armed states, and you know, Israel basically brought nuclear weapons into the region, attacked a country which, you know, all indications show was really, really, really eager to do a deal. And the reason is, I mean, Iran is not obviously a fully democratic society. I mean, it's not a democratic, it's a competitive authoritarian society. But there are really, there are societal levers in order to exert pressure. And there was significant pressure on the government to improve the economic situation. There was a lot of, you know, a lot of discontent amongst the middle classes, the low middle classes, and just the brutality of the sanctions over the last several years, as well as sort of economic mismanagement and so on, had really, you know, had really impoverished a huge number of people. It had really had a devastating, I've seen it amongst my own family, it's devastating. So there was significant pressure on sort of the Iranian government to do a deal. And basically the Pezeshkian government, who was recently elected, sort of was very much elected on this platform of negotiating with the United States, was elected on this platform of reaching a diplomatic settlement, and was elected on this platform of getting sanctions relief. This is what he was elected to do. And he had broad support across the political spectrum. So, you know, Iran sincerely pursued this. And what happened? They were attacked. I mean, they were attacked. And it's not only, and the thing is, I think I really also have to just center here. We have like over 800 people being killed right at this point. I mean, an uncle of a friend of mine was killed, was murdered. And, you know, just the shit. And it's just absolutely, and it really has alienated beyond measure, beyond words, countless Iranians, actually, who are really sympathetic, actually putting pressure on their government to do a deal with the United States. So that's kind of the situation. It's a completely corroded nuclear non-proliferation regime, and really, a government, but also people who are deeply now skeptical that they can trust a word coming out of the Trump administration's mouth. Because what happens? They say, we're going to negotiate with you, and then they end up, you know, bombing you, launching surprise attacks. Even the 2-week deadline, which Trump then said, "Oh, we'll give you 2 weeks, or we'll make a decision." You know, and then obviously Seymour Hersh published this piece saying the attack would happen over the weekend, and he actually was proven to be absolutely correct. So this is the situation we're in, and I really don't know how we're going to then how they're going to break through this sort of the trust, the sort of the lack of trust, the complete distrust that now exists.
Do you have any? I mean, it seems to me that the ability of the United States to get into any negotiation in any context has been severely damaged because of this. I mean, severely. And, Trump has effectively said, regardless whether it's like, you know, the Paris Accords or the original Obama nuke deal or just even these negotiations, it's completely, there's no credibility. I just don't know how any government anywhere could enter into negotiations with the United States and not feel like they're putting domestic, you know, themselves at risk domestically for looking like idiots and fools. What is your sense of why the United States did this? Like, we have the intel that seems to be unanimous that there is, that the Iranians have not had a program since 2003. Before you answer, actually, what your sense is in the United States, because I have, you know, who knows with Donald Trump at the end of the day. But the Iranians have enriched uranium to 60%, which is far greater than you need for a civilian use. Still 30% less than you need to even begin to make a weapon that could deliver it anywhere, et cetera, et cetera. But what is your sense? What was that, that increase in enrichment, what was that about?
My sense is that that was a way of gaining leverage. Because the reality is, you know, it's a massively asymmetrical kind of negotiation. I mean, and if you think about it, Iran entered the JCPOA it literally poured concrete into its heavy water reactor in Arak, so it could never be actually used again. And there was extreme criticism actually within Iran that you're basically destroying, like, actually, you know, real gains in our program, and you're giving up real material things for these ethereal things called sanctions, which the United States can just impose at no cost whatsoever, very capriciously. So, I mean, there was a lot of criticism within Iran in this regard as well. So my sense is that this time they were saying, okay, Trump's going to pull out in 2018. The Biden administration, which has a lot to answer for bringing us to this point, who basically kept Trump's, you know, quote unquote, maximum pressure. And I think we shouldn't really even use this euphemism. I think it's really, really actually dishonest. It's a form of economic warfare to really destroy and hollow out a society and create mass discontent so that that can then be weaponized. I mean, that's what it is. It's not, you know, maximum pressure is a euphemism. And we shouldn't, and, you know, millions of people, lives have been destroyed by this. I've seen it with my own eyes. It's just horrendous. So I think Iran was saying, okay, you're going to do that. We're going to build up this stockpile. We're going to use it as leverage. I think actually the issue is the Iranian leadership probably underestimated the willingness of both Netanyahu, post October 7th, basically to push all caution to the wind, and the United States basically to let any guardrails have been completely removed. I mean, and that should have been really clear from what he did to Lebanon when he was basically engaging in collective punishment and killed, you know, in excess of 3,000 people, basically carrying out outright sort of terrorist actions with his pager attack, which really was an act of state terrorism. It should have been, and obviously then killing Hassan Nasrallah, the Secretary General of Hezbollah, and basically destroying, you know, several apartment blocks in order to do that using a bunker buster bomb. I mean, when that was permitted and the whole world clapped, or at least most of the Western elites clapped, it should have been clear to Iran that basically there was no limits whatsoever. So I think probably Iran did make a miscalculation. They probably thought that they could do this and actually get a deal. And that's why they entered this negotiation, because the reality of it is, I mean, if they did decide to go and actually weaponize, pursue a nuclear deterrent before this, that's a political decision, which means they would have to effectively stop all cooperation with the IAEA. And therefore, that would basically, the whole world would be alerted to that. And then they would have to basically take the debris, actually turn it into a device, meld it into the metal that was necessary to put it on a warhead, then get, you know, the delivery device, all these sorts of things. This is actually a complex and very difficult process that would take considerable time. If you actually look at other states that have pursued weaponization, they're not members of the NPT overwhelmingly. The only one is North Korea, but Pakistan wasn't, India wasn't, and neither was Israel, obviously. So I think we have to take that into consideration. So all of this sort of scaremongering is just that, absolutely. And the reality why Iran didn't go down the route of a nuclear deterrent, which they might actually be very much regretting now, right, because obviously they can compare, you know, the fate of Libya with that of North Korea, is because they didn't want to bear the huge amount of economic isolation and the heavy political costs that would come from that. And why is that? Because they would receive significant pushback amongst the Iranian population. There would be, you know, protests, or there would be riots, or there would be significant political discontent. So that's why they didn't take that decision.
That discontent would probably theoretically be a little bit less in light of what's happened, and the idea that short of a nuclear weapon, we have no protection against these bombings. Where do you think this goes next?
Yeah, that's a really difficult one. I mean, my sense before this news that you've just informed me regarding the strike on Al-Udeid, possibly, I'm not sure. Will the Trump administration sort of leave it at that and say this was a tit for tat? Has this been in some sense choreographed? Even though, you know, but I think actually my sense initially before this news was that they might actually hold off on this. They weren't going to play the cards of the Strait of Hormuz. They weren't going to play. I mean, already we've seen sort of shipping insurance double. I mean, in a sense, and we actually, someone did send me an update from Donald Trump talking about oil prices. It does seem he's getting a little bit nervous there, actually. So I don't think Iran wants to play that card yet, which shows that they're actually, they don't feel existentially threatened. And they also have other options. I mean, I still think even though Hezbollah has been depleted, I think it is more than capable, actually, of entering into the fold. I think Ansarullah in Yemen is more than capable of, again, even more forcefully entering into the fold, possibly even closing the Bab al-Mandab Strait as well. These are all cards to play. But I think the main thing for the minute, they will be focusing particularly on Israel and actually ensuring that they've raised the cost sufficiently so that Benjamin Netanyahu does not actually try to normalize just bombing Iran anytime he feels like it.
Iskander Sadeghi, senior lecturer of history in the Middle East at the University of York. Thank you so much for your time today. We'll link to that piece in Jacobin, and perhaps we will speak again soon. Hopefully, this will be just a tit for tat situation, and it's hard to imagine. So. Yes.
Yeah, my family is displaced. Yeah, they're all displaced. They've left Tehran. Yeah,
because all right. Yeah, well, our thoughts with your family and
appreciate and it. Thank you so much for having me.
All right, appreciate your time. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. We're breaking format just a little bit today because of all the news. We have a big election in this city tomorrow. Really. More consequential, I think, than one would imagine this mayoral election because of who Andrew Cuomo is and who Zohran Mamdani is and where the Democratic Party is nationally. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Anthony Conright, writing in the Nation magazine, asking the question, will black Americans vote for a socialist. We'll be right back after this. We are back, Sam Seder, on the Majority Report. Emma Vigeland out for the week on her honeymoon when all this news is happening. Joining us now, Anthony Conright, writer, freelance writer, writing in The Nation, will black Americans vote for a socialist? Anthony, welcome to the program. There's a new poll out today from Emerson. Taken over, I think, just ending on Friday, with still 2 days of the early voting to take place, showing that Zohran Mamdani is within the margin of error in the first ballot and at 35 to 38, I believe it was, and is two or three points up in the eighth ballot. It's ranked choice voting. But one thing has been clear, in both in this polling and in prior polling, that Andrew Cuomo's biggest base of support is with African-American voters. Also, I should say Asian voters and Latino voters. and in the boroughs of the Bronx and Staten Island, which you wouldn't necessarily assume would be voting with each other. Give us your sense of, like, what is driving Cuomo support in the Black community in New York.
Right. So just for starters, to acknowledge, obviously, talking about race can sometimes get a little weird and awkward, and talking about people as a monolith can be a little problematic. But let's continue forward knowing that everything we say and ask is with the best of intention. And so with that being said, let's talk about Black voters.
Yeah, we, you know, we're talking broad strokes. Yeah. I mean, you know, you know, not all college educated people are voting for Zohran Mamdani. Not all Jews are voting in one way or another. But this is when we talk about electoral politics. A lot of times people get reduced down to, you know, one demographic if there's a consistency there. So but with that said.
So, okay, I think it's actually a part of sort of a larger project within establishment Democratic Party politics, in that if you can keep progressive leftist politicians away from Black folks, well, all we will tend to know are the establishment candidates. So one of the things that Zohran was experiencing early on was name recognition, right? And so that really is going to impact Black voters who tend to get their news from more establishment type programs. And then if you kind of think about Zohran's politics, we've been kind of trained to believe that anything that is democratic socialist is bad and is sort of anti-Black in a way. And unfortunately, like, those are all of the things that Black voters have to kind of combat in this race to sort of vote within their interests, you know. But as soon as Black folks hear about Zohran and hear about his politics, they're on board. I was actually getting my hair cut last week in, on 116th and Malcolm X, and my barber was like, he knows I write. And so he was like, yo, man, you know, what you think about this Zohran guy? I kind of like him. You know, what is, like, I'm 65 years old. And he goes, well, I don't want to, you know, I can't really say anything out loud because, you know, I'll be looked at like I'm crazy. And I was like, no, shout it from the corner. Like, we have to be, we have to expose folks in our community to ensure that, you know, we're voting within our best interests.
How much of it is, I mean, we saw this in the context of Bernie Sanders in 2016 and particularly in 2020. And, it, you know, with South Carolina voters, I mean, James Clyburn came out, endorsed Biden. Clyburn has done the same thing with Cuomo in this instance. How much of the dynamic is that Black people understand or have a sense of the stakes in an election? I mean, within the context of, like, a general election in the country, it seems to me the dynamic may be different than in New York City, but that, like, there's a concern that was articulated about Bernie Sanders that he can't win. Like, this was even a dynamic. This was even a dynamic with Obama early in 2000. I mean, I want to say through the summer of 2007 that he can't win, and in a general election, and therefore we have to make sure that we're putting up the best candidate. Now, I don't see how that would necessarily apply in New York, where, although Rudy Giuliani is probably still in people's minds, how much of it is it that versus the idea of a democratic socialist being seen as a white project?
Okay, I think it's all interconnected. But when you actually, like, break down the reasoning, you can actually, if you're thinking something is more racist than the other, like, imagine what it is like to tell a voting bloc, like, you cannot have any sort of progressive or leftist political aspirations. You have to be pragmatic, and you just have to sort of suffer slowly. And I think that's crazy. There's nothing pragmatic about poverty. There's nothing pragmatic about any sort of suffering. And we tend to only apply that type of thinking when it comes to Black folks. Like, you know, white people, if you look at Trump's voter base, they have allowed him to literally violate the Constitution, and no one was like, well, you know, he has to do so with some sort of pragmatism. He's been doing it full tilt. So I don't understand why all of a sudden when it comes to Black people, it's like, oh, well, we are so pragmatic. We will take our suffering very, very slowly, instead of having the audacity to have political aspirations that are outside the bounds of establishment party politics. And I think it's insane. I think that's more of a kind of like a narrative than it actually is, like more so than it is about what Black people need or should aspire to politically.
How much of this is a function of Barack Obama? Because, and I ask this because in 2012, I had the late Glenn Ford on from the Black Agenda Report. And his argument to me at the time, which I think, I mean, has obviously stuck with me for now for 12 years, was that that Obama was the greater of two evils between him and Mitt Romney, in the sense that Obama was undermining the long historical role of radicalism and socialism within the Black community, and was essentially short-circuiting it by being so pragmatic. And what's your sense of that?
Well, I think that's true to an extent. I don't think one man can sort of outdo with like an unethical system. So no matter who you put in there, like no one person's going to topple sort of the aspirations of the empire. And so, and I think one of the things that we all sort of did that was not fair to Barack Obama was sort of project our own hopes of what a Black president would mean, without sort of realizing that the last thing he could do as soon as he gets into office is actually sort of be a quote unquote Black president, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
So, you know, he kind of, in response to some of the stuff, but this is the thing with Obama, you know, in response to what Trump was doing, he had somewhere said, you know, imagine if I had did some of that. And it's like, well, I did imagine you do, like, you can, I wish you would have gone that far for the moral cause. And I think that's what's so frustrating to kind of look at sort of establishment Democratic Party politics, is that they've lost the ethical and moral calling to everything. It is a moral imperative to look at your neighbor, no matter what race they are, and say, you shouldn't die on the street. It's a moral imperative to say, in the richest country in the world, people shouldn't be homeless. It's crazy. How can, in New York City, you know, Cuomo is like doing the whole, well, if we raise taxes, then millionaires and billionaires, oh my God, we might lose a few. I don't know what we'll do without, you know, one of the 123 billionaires that lists New York City as our primary home. And it's like, I don't care. I'm more concerned with protecting the moral imperative than the political one. And so, fine, you might lose 10 billionaires, but you're losing hundreds and thousands of Black people who are displaced because they can't afford to live here, and white people too. And so I think what's super frustrating with what's going on, especially to watch some of the older Black statesmen, is that they've completely lost the moral imperative that Zohran is fighting for and advocating for.
Let me read to you, if you would, because this really stuck with me. If New York became a socialist economy, everything is free, Cuomo said. We tax the rich at an exorbitant rate. The rich will move to Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. I remember when we used to call Massachusetts Taxachusetts. I didn't, but that was New Jersey or Florida. And then you write, to be clear, 123 billionaires list New York City as their primary residence, the most in the world. And New York City is home to 384,500 millionaires, the most in the world. Cuomo mourns the prospect of losing this class, but does not grieve for the exodus of Black families, Black children, and Black teenagers forced out of New York City by the rising cost of living. I think that really, really puts things very well into perspective. From your perspective, I mean, you had the opportunity to, talk directly to your barber, who at 65 in particular is in a cohort that generally is more skeptical of non-establishment Democratic politicians. Mm. What is needed to mobilize the Black community? I mean, particularly in the context of a primary that's going to decide somebody that is more than likely. I mean, the Republican Party, Rudy Giuliani was last in Bloomberg, but that was almost two decades ago. Like, I mean, this, it seems mm-hmm. like New York City is not going to vote for a Republican. Certainly not going to be mm-hmm. Curtis Sliwa, or Sliwa. I can't remember how to say his name, but what is your sense that needs to happen in these communities to change their voting perspective?
Well, we have to broaden the sort of the people that we present in front of voters as sort of the I don't want to say like shepherds of Black voters, but they're so, like, for example, I am a super left Black atheist. Like, there aren't a lot of folks like me that are put in front of Black audiences. And I think that's like one of the things. So that way, you know, like people, like Black folks can see, like, oh, it's actually not a white thing to say, wow, everybody in the country should have health care. And if we do think it's a white thing, we go like, that's probably like, that says something about how we think about Black politics. But like, I think we kind of have to expand who folks are being exposed to. But also, I think just as a general rule of thumb is to remember to center ourselves in the moral imperative. I think like we really, really lost that. And part of that kind of happened once Black folks became sort of enrolled in the Democratic Party politics, which is actually, which, you know, happened after Martin Luther King Jr. died. And so in order to have political standing and to have like a seat at the table, there are some things that you kind of are forced to let go of that are sort of moral principles. And so I think part of that contributed to this. But I think at some point, not only Black folks, but like as a community, as a whole, you know, like on the Democratic side, we have to like we have the moral argument. Like, no one should die on the street. Full stop. Nobody should be homeless if they do not have to be. Full stop. Like, and I think just having hold of that, but moral clarity and presenting that and keeping that at the center of the sort of politics, I think would be the best thing.
Do you think, and I'm just wondering, like, you know, why Cuomo, what the appeal is? And I wonder if your sense is that in the Black community in New York City, there is any amount of jadedness that, I mean, that your barber is asking this question about Zohran this week. We're right. Closer to the election. I wonder if like a certain amount of, because in Black folk that I spoke to in the wake of the first Trump election, people were like, I'm not that surprised. I'm, you know, like there's a certain level of jadedness that I wonder, you know, and this obviously is just anecdotal, but I wonder if from your perspective, that jadedness causes engagement that might be a little bit later in the process. I mean, very few people know that the primary takes place. I mean, and I think this is going to help Mondomini, to be honest. But, you know, were it not for Mondomini in this race, most people I know would have no idea that there was a, like, I feel like the last one, barely anybody knew was even happening because people just don't pay attention to politics when it's 92 degrees out.
Right. So here's the thing. If you look at Trump, especially that first, his first win, one of the things he's like, well, the system is rigged. The tax system is gamed. Look at this war. Look at all. So he's kind of taking a critique of America that Black people have had for such a long time. Right. And then like using it. And then you have Democrats being like, what do you mean the system is rigged? No way. So he kind of like made Democrats defend an unethical and system that is rigged, which appeals to white people because white people are poor too. So Democrats were like, instead of finding a way to build a multiracial coalition that says, hey, the system is rigged, they let Trump have all of that ground. And Black people are, you know, like, obviously there was a small increase and whatnot with Black support for Trump. But I mean, like, what do you expect? If you're not, it's the best you can offer somebody is not Trump, or, you know, I'm with her, or this is, such an existential crisis, but we're not going to actually have any sort of politics that addresses like a moral concern. Well, what do you think is going to happen? And so, like, I think if Democrats would have been like, you know what? Yeah, there is police brutality. And white people, you know what? The police beat you and shoot you too. So we all need to get together to fight this. You know what? Rent is super high in New York, and it's disproportionately impacting Black people. But you know what? There's a lot of poor white people in New York too. And you know what? The system is rigged against you. It's also rigged against me. So let's get together and fight this thing. And so I think if you keep presenting a situation to a group of voters where it feels like nothing is going to change, no matter who you vote for, of course you're going to feel jaded and displaced and sad and despondent. Like, that's just a natural occurrence. But then unfortunately, you know, there aren't just a lot of Black people in the United States in general. And so we sort of disproportionately are impacted by those things. But like, if you don't give someone to hope for, you don't give people something to aspire to, what do you think is going to happen? And so we have, you know, Cuomo is going to Black churches being like, oh, well, you know, we, you know, be idealistic, but you have to be realistic. And I think that just is not a message that you see from the conservative party. They're not saying, well, we have to pragmatically use ICE to round people up. They're like, we'll get a few Mexicans here. We'll even get some white people. We'll just start picking people off the street without due process. Who cares? We're just going to do it until we get the desired results. And I think like that's the kind of energy we have to have on the opposite side of the coin. I'm not necessarily, you know, like, I don't care if there are a bunch of billionaires and millionaires who end up leaving the city. Like, my sort of moral concern and ethical concern isn't with them. It's my concern is for the person who's sleeping on the street around the corner from my house. Like, I don't want that person to be displaced. My concern is for people who can't afford to take the bus. Like, my concern is for lowering police contact with people who are on the bus. And you know, a good way to do that is if you have universal bus transportation. It's like, I just think if you present people with sort of a moral North Star and you say, I don't care what your race is. I don't care, you know, wherever you are, rural, urban, in a city, like in the richest country in the world, we shouldn't have people who are dying on the street. Like, I just think it's like, it's that simple. And I think we just sort of, the party has to do a better job of making that the message. Instead of like, you know, have the audacity of a little bit of hope.
The irony, too, is that Cuomo talks about his concern about capital flight from New York State. In the meantime, he's lowering he was lowering taxes on them.
Right.
So what's the point?
Right.
Like, we're just there's going to be some store on Madison Avenue that's going to close because people aren't buying, you know, fur sinks anymore or whatever it is. Anthony Conright, we will put a link to your piece in The Nation magazine. Much appreciated.
Oh, no. Thank you for having me on again. Sorry for calling in so many times. I was that one caller that called like 2 weeks ago.
Appreciate it.
No problem.
Glad to connect.
Thank you.
All right, folks.
Brother.
We're going to head to the fun half. We should reiterate that there have been reports, and I think it has now been confirmed that Iran has attacked that U.S. base in Qatar with missiles. This is the Al Udeid Air Base. This is where the forward headquarters of CENTCOM is located. It's the biggest base in the region. Matt Duss, earlier in the program, said that there was reason to believe that's where the Iranians would strike. And it appears that he was correct. Now, as I mentioned earlier, if you had Googled that, I mean, the attack apparently took place 30 or 40 minutes ago. If you had Googled it 30 or 40 minutes ago, you would see reports as early as like 3 to 4 to 5 hours earlier that an attack may be imminent on that base. So it's clear that Iran was giving a heads up, ostensibly to minimize U.S. casualties, in an attempt to perhaps de-escalate. Iran says the missile attack matched the number of U.S. bombs. So basically just saying this is a tit for tat.
Look at how proportional we can be.
It is like this happened after Soleimani, too. We are told that the Iranian regime, and make no mistake, I have a real problem with religious fundamentalism. If you've been watching the show for any period of time, you would know this. I am not a supporter of the Iranian regime. I'm not a supporter of many governments, to be honest with you. But
list them all.
But to the extent that I am a supporter of any governments, Iran, the Iranian regime is not one of them.
Like the ones that aren't doing wars.
The story that I have been told since 1979 was that the Iranians are irrational, they're madmen, that they they're complete. They don't act rationally. This, of course, was also the story of Saddam and Gaddafi and every other person we ever bombed. Noriega, I don't know.
Japanese.
The guy, you know, the guy in Grenada. They're all madmen, crazy people.
Oh, yeah, Mossadegh.
I mean, I wasn't around. I'm just going by what I, like, literally what I remember hearing. And it really appears that every time we attack Iran, there is an attempt to de-escalate, which suggests to me that they're not so crazy. They realize
that
it's not going to work. Yes.
Decades of being the rational actor is all just to trick us.
Exactly.
And it's driving us crazy.
This is the long con. 35 years. And then one day they just, 50 years. 40 years? 45 years. Oh, Jesus. All right. We're going to take a break, head into the fun half. You can support this program by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get the free show free of commercials, but you also get the fun half. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, hot chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. You can buy the Majority Report blend. I don't know what's going to happen to the WTF blend, which is Mark Maron's show, once he goes off air. My guess is it'll still sit there languishing. I did want to mention, though, in the conversation with Anthony Conright, that not only do I remember that interview with Glenn Ford, but the one joke of Mark Maron's I remember, and I've remembered it for 16 years, and I've heard a lot of his jokes. Maybe the other ones I remember were just completely inappropriate to talk about. But the one joke I do remember from the Air America days was that after Barack Obama, or in the lead up to the potential for Barack Obama to get elected, Marin had a joke was, if Barack Obama wins, finally, black people in this country will have an opportunity to be screwed over by one of their own. And it turned out to be fairly indicative. Barack Obama was basically, you know, and there was some good stuff. The Medicaid expansion and, the Iranian nuke deal. Oh, well. Matt, what's happening on Left Reckoning?
Left Reckoning. We talked about Iran again, patreon.com/Left Reckoning, and kind of how this whole anti-war right wing would basically be like the new Coke. And I think we're seeing it evaporate right in front of our eyes.
All right, folks, see you in the fun half. 3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. The Majority
Report. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Fun. Matt.
Who? Fun. What is up, everyone? Fun. Nomi Key.
You did it. Fun. Let's go, Brandon.
Fun.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women.
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this 7A?
Yes.
Hi, me? Is this me?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
Oh, I'm going to go for that.
Ooh, libertarian.
They're so stupid though.
Common sense says of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say.
857-210-35-501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop.
You call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt.
Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out.
I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.
This is really fantastic.
All right, folks. Ramona Frankenstein says, Sam, I appreciate having a voice from your generation that speaks out against war. Granted, I can't imagine you'd be pro-war after seeing all your friends die in the trenches during the Great War. I'm wondering if Ramona Frankenstein is actually Saul texting me from school. That is definitely one of my son's type of California resistance. Sam Sagar is suggested today. I assume that's Sagar and Jetty. Today, because Khamenei is so old, he has nothing to lose, and Iran might fight to the death. Same old thing. Hey, it's just, dude, look who's president of this country. Like, I don't understand I just don't understand. It is just some type of bizarre, I don't know if it's racism or just xenophobia or, but the mentality, that just the level of maturity that is associated with someone's brain, where it's just like, they've got to be crazy. And look at our president.
Our entire policy is to drive them crazy. It's to do things that are so aggressive and see, like, well, are you going to respond to that? And if they respond, you get to do more bombing of them. And if they don't, then they lose support internally.
Vatov, yesterday in Qatar and Bahrain, they announced remote work and mandate and shifting flights movement. So, like, it's clear there was a tip-off in an attempt to minimize casualties, to minimize the chances that this escalates. All right, the pretzels that figures on the right are turning themselves into, in an attempt to justify Donald Trump's attack on Iran and square it with the notion that Donald Trump was going to be an anti-war president that they had to sell to different segments of our population. Remember, the guarantee was that Hillary Clinton was going to get us into a war with Iran. Then it was that Kamala Harris was going to get us into a war with Iran. If we do not get into a war, an extended war with Iran, in this moment, it is a function of the Iranians. I mean, there is no way that someone could bomb us and we would not get into a war with them. How do I know this? Because some non-state actors committed a terrorist attack in this country in 2001, and we invaded two different countries and would have invaded more had we not been so incompetent in those invasions. Here is J.D. Vance explaining to us why Donald Trump's attack on Iran is different than somebody else's hypothetical attack on Iran.
And the second thing is, Kristen, I certainly empathize with Americans who are exhausted after 25 years of foreign entanglements in the Middle East. I understand the concern, but the difference is that back then we had dumb presidents, and now we have a president who actually knows how to accomplish America's national security objectives. So this is not going to be some long, drawn-out thing. We've got in. We've done the job of setting their nuclear program back. We're going to now work to permanently dismantle that nuclear program over the coming years, and that is what the president has set out to do. Simple.
This is one of the, like, I mean, the absolute disdain for the public that J.D. Vance illustrates here is impressive. The entire intelligence apparatus of this country has said there was no nuclear weapon program. The entire apparatus. And now, even the most loyal of Trump officials say that we don't really know if we took the whole thing out at all.
Obliterate, though.
I mean, if we set it back, the program back 3 or 4 months, that means that they still have it tomorrow or something based upon what...
It'll be 5 months based on their timeline.
Exactly. This is just absurd. And reminder, Trump broke off negotiations to allow Israel to attack Iran. I mean, there's no coherence to any of this. None. Here is Donald Trump commenting on the future Donald Trump.
This is when Obama was president.
Yes.
Our president will start a war with Iran because he has absolutely no ability to negotiate. He's weak and he's ineffective.
There you go. Thank you. Well said. I mean, the idea that anybody would get into negotiations with the United States now is just absurd.
Yeah.
It'll happen, but it will be... And understand, this is not like, you know, Matt and I had an agreement and Matt broke his word to me. And so I'm going to just trust that Matt is going to keep his word this time. These leaders all have constituencies. They have domestic opposition. They have domestic supporters. If I am domestic opposition to the Iranian leadership, and I am more hardline, and they go into a negotiation with the United States, I'm just out there going, are you kidding me? Are you nuts? In what world would you enter negotiations with them and trust them? They're just lulling you into a false sense of security, so they're going to bomb you again.
It's Lucy in the football territory.
Old Chomsky says we should remind people that Iran only started enriching uranium to 60% after Trump left the JCPOA in his first term. Of course. And it makes complete sense. The idea that they couldn't get to 90% in those 4 or 5 years is absurd. Of course they could. But our intelligence has said that they're not building a weapon. The whole point of going to 60% is a leverage point. You go in, you say, I only want to pay $5 for this car, which you know is $15 less than, you know, the car should cost. It's a very cheap car. And you give yourself some negotiation room. It's just...
The sites we bombed were also ones that the UN had inspected. You know, under a regime, we would have inspections of those things to make sure they're not breaking out, and you tear that up, and all of a sudden we don't know what's the only solution is to bomb them.
We need to check in with the least likely person who is skeptical about the attack on Iran. Credit where credit is due. Yes, it's our old friend, Vinny. From Patrick Bet David show, as the, I'm going to just say it, the voice of reason on the Patrick Bet David show. It's that broken clock again. It strikes noon.
So, so Nancy, and because I'm going to give you, what do you say to the
with Nancy Mace in studio here?
Nancy Mace in studio.
So Nancy, and because I'm going to give you, what do you say to the people that have seen, for instance, Bibi Netanyahu for 40 years saying Iran is 2 weeks away from a nuclear weapon, 2 years later, Iran is, and now it's gone to the point where the people are questioning the intelligence because, for instance, if I want, mind you, Bibi is very, very unliked in his own country. There was about to be a revolution before October 7th happened. What do you say to the people that are like, you know,
there wasn't a revolution just before October 7th. There were massive protests against a proposed legislation to essentially disempower an independent judiciary in that country. I wouldn't call it a revolution, but he's on a roll.
You know what? Just like when I was in the United States Air Force during Bush, trust me, one of the reasons I left was because they lied.
And they did lie.
And which Bibi was one of the main voices saying Saddam Hussein has nuclear weapons and taking out Saddam would cause positive reverberations throughout the region. It did anything but. So what do you say to the people that are like, hey, listen, Israel, and I get it, he doesn't want anybody to freaking have nuclear weapons, especially Iran that says, you know, they're little Satan and we're big Satan. But what do you say to the people that this story seems like it's the same story? That's one question. And the second one is, what is the plan for the regime change? If you're going to go in there and take everybody out, we've talked about this. Mm-hmm. Is there a plan kind of behind the curtains that's like, okay, Reza or somebody, because if you just take everybody out, those 92 million people are going to be like, who, what about us? So what do you?
Yeah, no, I agree. I was with you on Iraq, the whole weapons of mass destruction and what we did to our country, taking away our liberties after that, spying on Americans and everything. And we were lied to. The difference here, this to me...
Also, the hundreds of thousands of Iraqis that we killed may be worth a mention.
Oh, wow! We lost 4,000 lives in Iraq. All you're talking about is up to a million Iraqis that we killed or caused to be killed in the subsequent chaos. Yeah. And the 2 million internal refugees and 2 million external refugees. But... I mean,
spying was bad too. Don't get me wrong.
But. It also caused a lot of dissent. I mean, we lost a whole decade of Dixie Chicks albums.
Spying on Americans and everything, and we were lied to. The difference here, this to me, it feels different. I have been briefed. I have been in a skiff and heard some of the intel that has been acquired. Now, you know, different intelligence agencies and countries might have a slightly different timeline. But,
pause it for a second. What I think she's trying to say there in not so many words is that our country says that the timeline is an infinite horizon because they have not resumed their program since 2003. There is a hypothetical. How long would it take from today to get to a nuclear weapon? And it's probably 5 years because it's 5 years for every country in the world. Generally speaking, if they have, you know, sort of a certain baseline of expertise and industrial capacity. Just like, how long would it take for me personally to do it? It would probably be 15, 20 years if I had, maybe if I had $1 billion, it would be even less. But that doesn't mean I'm going to do it. So that's what she's talking about. Israel says that they have it, like they've been saying for 25, 30 years. But the United States says, well, if they decided tomorrow, it would take them 5 years. That's what she's talking about.
Yeah. Let's skip a little bit ahead here. That's all she says. It feels different because she's been in a skiff. This is where Patrick sort of brings Vinny back into the fold.
Bombing in Iran was the second time that he had been in the Situation Room, and then earlier this week made the third time.
So he's been in a Situation Room three times, once in his first term, two times in the last week, okay? Two times in the last week and a half, give or take. This is what I'm asking you. Don't think like a pundit. Don't think like a podcaster. Don't think about, let me say what it is to go viral because I want the community to like and retweet and all that other stuff. Because sometimes that's how the market thinks about it. Think about it from the standpoint. You were in the military, I was in the military. You're Air Force, I'm Army, right? Both of us were not supportive of the Iraq war. Spent trillions of dollars, wasted time, bullshit. It was full of it. They were just kind of using propaganda, 9/11, all this stuff. I don't want to get deep into it.
Yeah.
I've done plenty of interviews where people know where our position is with that. Don't support, they get a nuclear weapon. If you have to choose, you can't do one without the other. We do nothing, they get a nuclear weapon.
Pause
Should
it.
We do anything?
He literally just did what the entire war machine going to Iraq did, which was claim that they had weapons of mass destruction. And where's the evidence? Do you want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud?
Clearly you want to give Saddam the button right now if you're asking for evidence.
I mean, that is literally, having lived through this, exactly what they did. Is it, do we invade or do we get blown up? Do we invade or is it weapons of mass destruction released on the United States?
Mushroom cloud.
Mushroom cloud, anthrax. He literally is doing exactly what he just said in the breath before. We're not going to do that again. The U.S. intelligence agencies, all of them, this is according to Tulsi Gabbard, who I have absolutely very little appreciation for as a person. She has absolutely no incentive to come out and lie about what the U.S. intelligence says. In fact, we haven't even heard a claim that she mischaracterized it or any of that. It is, she has said, in U.S. intelligence agencies say that they have not had a weapons program since 2003. So the option isn't, do we attack or they have a nuclear weapon? It is, they don't have a nuclear weapon program. So do we just keep negotiating and figure out how to make it in their best interest to give up even the capacity to have that aspiration? They don't have the aspiration. We just want to take away the capacity if they ever had the aspiration. Go back a little bit. Let's hear Patrick Bet-David make that
brainwashing.
Brainwash. Let's see if that works on Vinny.
Let me say what it is to go viral, because I want the community to like and retweet and all that other stuff.
Don't sometimes be that's audience a- captured. You're that's what he's saying.
Anti-war for clicks is what he's saying to Vinny, even though he was in the Air Force and felt lied to.
Let me say what it is to go viral, because I want the community to like and retweet and all that other stuff. Because sometimes that's how the market thinks about it. Think about it from the standpoint. You were in the military. I was in the military. You're Air Force. I'm Army, right? Both of us were not supportive of the Iraq war. Spent trillions of dollars, wasted time, bullshit. It was full of it. They were just kind of using propaganda, 9/11, all this stuff. I don't want to get deep into it.
Yep.
I've done plenty of interviews.
You don't want to get too deep into it because you're just about to do it now.
Don't support. They get a nuclear weapon. If you have to choose, you can't do one without the other. We do nothing.
Amazing.
They get nuclear weapons. Should we do anything? Should he attack the way he did with Qasem Soleimani?
Attack what? Because here's my thing.
So say Israel can't
surgical?
Do it by themselves.
But here's my question. Israel can't. Do you think Israel doesn't have the capability to do this by themselves?
Do.
I do too. So why do we have to get involved?
No, I know. All I'm saying to you is I think they do.
Me too.
And I want this to be their fight.
100%.
Yeah, to me, like when the boys are fighting, you've seen me when I'm with the kids.
Course.
I'm like, listen, I'm out of this one.
Yeah.
Go in and fight it out.
Yeah. It's just
guys,
like
right?
with the kids.
But
it's just like with the kids. It is just like with the kids. When the two kids are fighting, you're like, I'm not going to do this.
Even if one of the kids you're sort of subsidizing to the tune of billions of dollars.
And maybe it ends up destabilizing the entire $26 million mansion they live in. Oh, it looks like the pool was blowing up. Whoa, there goes the kitchen. All right, guys. Calm down.
I guess we've got to take out one of these kids' nuclear capabilities.
Exactly. Did you do your reading before you blew that up? Did you do your reading before you blew up the cat? Did you do your reading? Okay.
But if it gets to a point that I need to get involved, do I let them fight because I know one of my sons knows Muay Thai and allow him to beat the crap out of the other one?
No.
So at what point, if something happens that they're simply not willing to do it, should we get involved?
Okay. Now, if it's up to that point where they are and they're trying to move like that, then they're putting us in a situation that we have to. For right now, I think Israel could take it by themselves.
Well, watch what you just said, Vinny. Very important, because you, when you and I talk, you're a reasonable, logical guy. So you just went to, if it gets to the point that shit could hit the fan, then no matter what on your list is, you don't want Iran to have nuclear.
I do not want.
Okay.
Period.
Right.
100%.
Okay.
I don't want them. I don't. With this leadership, this guy, that right there, burning the American flag. Hell no. But again, Pat, I am about, and I get it, he's in the situation room. If the intelligence is correct, coming from Israel, that they're there, that they're right there, and this is the attitude, up to a point, let Israel do what Israel has to do. But if we have to get involved,
there's
because
a picture
they
of a guy in a turban. Gotta be clear. Got it. Totally crazy. Completely irrational. Amazing.
And it's not let Israel have to do. That's not the anti-war position. The anti-war position is get back into diplomatic talks with this country and also non-proliferation for every country.
Exactly.
This is going to make Iran more incentivized.
We have two nuke powers bombing another country, one of whom is the only country in the history of man that has dropped nuclear weapons on people. Amazing.
Thanks for trying, Vinny.
Yeah, good. A for effort. A for effort. Just a reminder, guy's wearing a turban. Like, it's like in Iran, they're like, look at how orange this president is. He's orange.
They said death to America, so I guess, you know, bomb some mountains.
Here is Marco Rubio trying to address the fact that all of the U.S. intelligence on Iran has consistently shown that the Iranians are not pursuing a nuclear weapon and have had no program to do so since 2003. How do you deal with this? You don't want to go on there and go, but Israel says it's the case, because Israel's been saying it's the case for 25 years. This is the slowest march to nuclear weapon in the history of nuclear weapons. Here is Marco Rubio. Here's the best he came up with.
Up on a phrase you just word, weaponization ambitions. Are you saying there that the United States did not see intelligence that the Supreme Leader had ordered weaponization?
That's irrelevant. I think that question being asked on the media, that's an irrelevant question.
No, they have that everything is the key point in U.S. intelligence assessments. You know
no,
that.
No, it's not.
Yes, it was.
No, it's
that
not.
The political decision had not been made.
Well, I know that better than you know that, and I know that that's not the case.
But I'm asking you whether the order was given.
And the people who say that, it doesn't matter if the order was given. They have everything they need to build nuclear weapons. Why would you bury things in a mountain 300 feet under the ground?
Right.
Why would you bury why do they have 60% enriched uranium? You don't need 60% enriched uranium. The only countries in the world that have uranium at 60% are countries that have nuclear weapons. Because
right.
they can quickly make it 90. They have all the elements. They have why do they have a space program? Is Iran going to go to the moon? No.
Pause They're it for a second. I want to remind you that 20 years ago, George W. Bush said that Iran was part of the axis of evil. It was Iran, Iraq, and North Korea. Iraq was shattered. If I'm Iran, why would I have 60% uranium? Because I need some type of protection. I need the idea that I could do this, even though I don't want to. Because how else do I stop the world's most powerful military from bombing me? It's a very basic, easy question. How do I, like,
supposedly why we have them?
I look at Libya and they gave up their nuclear program. It was a guy named Muammar Gaddafi who is 6 feet underground now. Like, it's the only possible protection that they have. And so, despite the fact that they don't want to have a program, despite the fact they don't have a program, they imply that we could have a program if you continue to do something like bomb us.
You don't need 60% enriched uranium. The only countries in the world that have uranium at 60% are countries that have nuclear weapons. Because it can quickly make it 90. They have all the elements. They have. Why do they have a space program? Is Iran going to go to the moon? No. They're trying to build an ICBM.
No, but that's a question. That's a question of intent. And you know, in the intelligence assessment, that it was that Iran wanted to be a threshold state and use this leverage. I'm talking about the public March assessment, and that's why I was asking you if you know something more from March.
But that's also an inaccurate representation of it. That's an accurate representation of it. That's not how intelligence is read. That's not
now. First off, Marco Rubio is saying that it's the wrong takeaway from that intelligent assessment. The next question really should be, then why is the director of national intelligence not invited in the room as you guys are making these decisions? It's almost like you don't want to hear from the intelligence community. Go ahead.
Of it. That's an accurate representation of it. That's not how intelligence is read. That's not how intelligence is used. Here's what the whole world knows. Now, forget about intelligence. What the IAEA
forget about
knows,
intelligence.
They are enriching uranium well beyond anything you need for a civil nuclear program. So why would you enrich uranium?
She
at
just
60%
answered threshold.
Right. If you don't intend to one day use it to take it to 90 and build a weapon, right. Why are you developing ICBMs?
Leverage.
Why do you have 8,000 short range missiles and 2,000 to 3,000 long mid-range missiles that you continue to develop?
Pause.
Why do you do all these things?
I think we found out the answer about those short-range missiles 2 weeks ago when Israel unilaterally started a war on Iran.
They have a crazy neighbor they want to deter, is the answer.
Why do you have 8,000 short-range missiles and 2,000 to 3,000 long mid-range missiles that you continue to develop? Why do you do all these things? They
Understood.
Have everything they need for a nuclear weapon.
Why do we
they have
do
the
it?
Delivery mechanisms. They have the enrichment
capability.
Why do
capability. We do it?
They have the highly enriched uranium that is stored.
Yes.
That's all we need to see.
Right. Well,
why do we do it? We have a lot more than 8,000 missiles. Why do we do it? Peace through strength. Peace through strength. I mean, this is all such bullshit. It's amazing. It's amazing. It's even more amazing than it was during Iraq because, A, like 6 weeks ago, none of these guys were saying any of this stuff. And the level of savvy that the country has to this stuff is much higher than it was back then. And there's no state of shock from 9/11. It is impressive that they can go on and also be so bad at it. I feel like there are Instagram influencers, you know, hawking some type of like, homeopathic stuff that sounds more convincing than this. It's nuts.
It really is the tragedy and farce sort of thing.
It totally is.
Who knew the Iraq War wasn't the farce?
I honestly thought this guy was dead. I mean, we just haven't heard anything of Rudy Giuliani. But he's on Newsmax Sunday Agenda. And he, now to be fair, he is renting out his house to a, some type of like, Nosferatu, production. And so the lighting is very, very strange for him in his house right now.
Is he welding?
A mad scientist.
Exactly. What's the best way to get glare on my glasses? Do that one. Okay, here he is.
The grandpa encouraged.
Here he is talking about AOC. He's always been so obsessed with her.
Sacha Baron Cohen kind of proved what.
I was just going to say.
I find what the Democrats are doing, they want an impeachment. They should be tried for treason. American military personnel are right now in harm's way coming back from that strike.
They're
in harm's way all over the Middle East, and they're condemning the president.
Right, you're referring to Andrew
Simon.
Against
the country that wants to annihilate.
Right,
how much justification do you need this? They wanted to annihilate us for 40 years.
Right, Congressman, you're referring to Congresswoman AOC, who's now calling for President Trump's impeachment. People seem to forget.
Are they trying to convince him he's a congressman?
People seem to forget everything. The way that you can tell which Democratic lawmaker is lying about like what they want out of this is twofold. One, there are basically three positions that you can take on this. I guess four. One is we should not be bombing Iran, which is generally also coupled with, and the president does not have the constitutional authority to do this. And then you have the people who want to bomb Iran, but don't want to say so full-throatedly. And they'll say just that the president doesn't have the authority to do this. He must bring this to Congress so that we can decide on this. And then you have people who sort of like want to hedge in between that they just complain, we were not consulted about this. Which means that they don't want to push the fact that Trump brings this to the... Because if they did say this is unconstitutional, they'd have to take the next step and what are you going to do about it? And then there, of course, there are the ones who just say, like, I'm glad we bombed Iran.
And that's actually important context. AOC called for Trump's impeachment over this, which I was glad to see her do.
Yep. Which one's that?
This is a different one, but I have the description in your chat. This is Zohran at the National Action Network's conference here talking about forward progressive vision.
We're on the eve of Election Day. It's going to be a big one. It's going to be very hot. Apparently, if you support Cuomo, it clogs your pores and increases your risk of heat stroke. That's not nice. Go out and vote, regardless of who you're voting for.
Got to use fear.
Unless. Here is Zohran Mamdani at Al Sharpton's National Action Network. Now, did Sharpton endorse Cuomo? Did he?
I believe he was at least making noises in that direction. I'm not sure here, but here Zohran quotes Sharpton right in front of him.
And I believe, will you just Google that and see?
Yeah.
Because... listen, I don't like Al Sharpton. I mean, I don't dislike him as a person. He seems fine. But Al Sharpton is a very dodgy character. There's back in the day, there were stories written about him being an informant when he was younger. There are stories about the ability to get the National Action Network to do what you want it to do, involving sometimes some type of remuneration. But the fact is that he's, you know, his MSNBC gig really helped his image.
Sharpton hasn't endorsed, but has been praising Cuomo at recent rallies.
And sometimes, you know, Sharpton's pretty good at, like, that's the way I encourage people to do certain things. Here is Zohran Mamdani at the National Action Network. Al Sharpton, Spike Lee in attendance, apparently.
And I actually think of the words that Reverend Sharpton shared when he was running for president. He shared... There are those in the Democratic Party who have driven the party further and further to the right in the name of a winning strategy. And it seems that it is their presumption that the only way to be electable is that progressive forces and people of color must voluntarily turn into invisible people. And I have spent this campaign speaking to those so-called invisible people. I have spoken to the New Yorkers who do not see themselves in their politics, do not see themselves in their politicians, and do not see themselves in the policies that are being proposed. And what I have found is that it is time to bring those from the margins to the mainstream. It is time for us to make every New Yorker visible across this city. But when we stand up and do so, we will face the wrath of all the money in the world. And so right now, you will see more than $20 million being spent against me, $20 million being trying to redefine me. But let me tell you who I am. I am a man who believes in the possibility of this city. I am one who believes that we must win a new city, a city for each and every New Yorker, one they can afford, one they can do more than just struggle. And to do that, we have to leave behind the old city and the old politicians and the old ways that gave us the struggle that we're living in today. So it is my hope to not only earn your consideration, to not only earn your vote, but to earn your partnership. Because what I want to do is lead this city alongside each and every one of you. And it would be a dream if you gave me that opportunity on Tuesday, June 24th. Thank you so much.
Yeah, that was smart to quote Sharpton.
That's great.
I also noticed that Mamdani is wearing a different cut suit. It is not the sort of like hipper tight suit, but the more
baggier,
a little bit baggier. And I don't know if that's I don't know where the style of suits are.
Nor do I.
Because all my suits are like literally from my bar mitzvah practically. But I do notice that. And I wonder if that's, you know, a way of just sort of trying to be not associated with what the kids are doing these days.
Yeah.
Smart. Go out and vote. Andrew from D.C., I know you guys aren't big fans of Polymarket, but they just moved him from 18% to win to 52% to win today alone.
Responding to the same poll, basically.
Yeah, I would imagine. All right, this is really ugly stuff. ICE continues to be jackbooted thugs. And there's more and more sort of like reporting, and I don't know how accurate it is. Although, if you go back to the reports in the wake of Independence Square, when protesters were fired upon and trampled by horses, there were reports that at that time that a lot of those federal officers were actually transferred over from the federal prison system, correction system, that a lot of these guys are corrections officers. And I think it's known that, you know, corrections officers, generally, not all, don't want to paint with too broad of a brush, are, would-be aspirational cops who couldn't get into the police force. And there have been, you know, reports that they needed to, you know, they were trying to get IRS officers, agents to work with ICE, to be deputized as ICE. And I suspect a lot of these guys are correctional officers. And that would explain, too, why a lot of them want to wear masks. Because it wouldn't surprise me if that was some like edict from up above. Like, we don't want you to be identified because we don't want the public to know where you're coming from. That you have no training in any of this. And you're coming from brutal situations where there is a long track record of brutalization, of prisoners. And the idea that you would treat these people like, well, shouldn't be treating prisoners that way, but the idea that you would treat them like prisoners, you know, as opposed to behind the walls of a prison where nobody can see you. Here is a guy named Narciso Barranco. He has three sons who are Marines. He has been in this country for 30 years. He is working at a job landscaping, and some ICE guys roll up, literally roll up on him, and the video starts. They have already got him down to the floor. There's, I don't know, at least a half a dozen guys there.
It's a weed whacker in the foreground.
You see the weed whacker. So he just got jumped from behind. This is in Orange County, California, in an IHOP parking lot where he was weed whacking. And the ICE guys not only spray him with pepper spray, but begin to beat him. There's no sound on this, but you can see the ICE guy just punching him. His arms are behind his back now.
Pushing him down by
punching,
the neck.
Punching.
Punching him in the back of the head. Other guys in like helmets, masks.
They all got their Buffy outfits on.
He was weed whacking.
We got the weed whacker right here. Six guys.
Would that cost just that, this half hour alone?
Look at his face. You can see his face completely. Father of three Marines.
It's disgraceful. Oh,
shoving him in with that baton. I mean, just absolute Nazi stuff. Gestapo. Jackbooted thugs. Disgusting. Absolutely disgusting. Let's play this video. I saw it on Instagram. It's a woman who voted for Trump. That's what this one is in the 11? Yeah.
The woman didn't vote for it, but after the dialogue, the woman was regretting because
of it. Oh, I think it's the same woman. I think it's the same woman. I think. This is a South Florida woman. There's two videos here. One is she's reading off the story of her father. And then a couple of days later, she's addressing camera. She looks different in the second video because she's got more makeup on. But you can see by the fingernails. No, not this one. The other one. Yep.
Deserves to vote. Through something like this behind bars. He has lived in Florida for more than half his life and worked for the same construction job for many decades. Every day that goes without him here is a day lost forever. This is about being human, about love, connection, and presence. The one thing he needs the most is the one thing that we're being kept from giving him, which is us. I feel that it would be immoral and inhumane to let a man who is suffering, who is terminally ill, spend what little time he has left in pain and isolation. Please don't let him die in a cell. Please don't let his final memories be of those of pain and isolation. The American flag stands for compassion, kindness, liberty, and justice for all. We're all human, and today I'm asking for one human act of compassion to please let my dad come home.
My vote, again, is to deny the request for conditional medical release.
When I voted for Trump...
Oh, pause it. I think that first thing is her testimony in a hearing. And a couple of days later, she speaks of her regret voting for Trump.
I supported the very system that allows this kind of cruelty to happen. I've spent the last few days reflecting, and I feel like I came through some sort of revelation. I questioned my beliefs, my choices, and my role in all of it.
My vote wasn't just a mistake. It was the ultimate betrayal of the very people that I come from. I feel like living in South Florida, surrounded by Republican voices, I was brainwashed into thinking I was one of them. I fell for the propaganda, the normalization of cruelty, and I believed the lies that gave me a false sense of security and belonging. I was convinced that voting for Trump was for the economy or against crime, when in reality, I was supporting a man and a movement that dehumanizes people. He basically built his platform on targeting immigrants, spreading hate, and pushing policies that ultimately broke families apart. I regret my vote so, so, so deeply, and if I could go back and change it, I would. I'm reading, listening, learning, and unlearning everything that I thought I knew. And to anyone who is feeling the same regret as I am, I want you guys to know that there's still a way for us to move forward, but it starts with honesty first. To every single person who has been affected by the choice that I made, I am so, so sorry. A lot of you aren't going to forgive me, and I'm really not expecting anyone to, but I just want everyone to know that I'm going to move forward with more compassion, continue educating myself, and fight for those who can't fight for themselves.
I mean, my heart goes out to her, losing her dad in that way. And good for her for having the introspection and the awareness going forward.
You see how important the whole apparatus that was, oh, they're just going to go after criminals, was to the propaganda value there.
100%.
It swung the election for him. Everybody in media who was propagating that helped swing the election and helped bring this result around.
100%. These obvious fictions, building up this stuff, creating the sort of like, you know, the sort of backfilling. There's, you know, if you look at it in the context of construction, you can build a wall, but on one side, you put in rocks and soil so that it holds it up. And that's what, like, the hyping of crime, the idea that they're going to arrest criminals. Why would you ever want criminals on here? There's trend to agua everywhere. What happened to them? What happened to them? Did they just mysteriously go away? I mean,
are they disguising themselves as weed whackers now?
92% of the people we sent down to CECOT were not criminals. Internal documents at ICE now are showing, like, their claim that only 30% of the people we're rounding up are not criminals is a lie. It's just a lie. And it's also, frankly, it's the same dynamic with the trans stuff. We're going to be talking to Chase Strangio on Wednesday. But this whole notion of, like, we're just protecting women's sports. And Supreme Court now has basically opened the door for banning all trans care, period. And it was,
of course. I was told it was just going to be for minors, I thought.
Of course, this is what they were doing. So obvious. I mean, where's the caravans? Wasn't there a caravan?
Lake Minnetonka still safe, apparently.
Yep. All right, let's end on a good note. Mahmoud Khalil was released yesterday. Court found that he could no longer be held, that the reasons in which he's being held were all BS. He is on a conditional release. He can only travel to, I think, four states. Michigan, where he has family. It's off the top of my head. Washington, D.C. to lobby. I think New Jersey and New York. He had to give up his passport and his visa to ICE in Tennessee. But he's returned home. He's free for the time being. He can spend time with his child who was born while he was being detained. And here he is at the Newark airport returning home yesterday. He's there. You can see his wife is there. AOC met him there to greet him. Chuck Schumer, I think, left the state. And shortly after that, he goes right out in front of Columbia and speaks at a protest.
Who is Mahmoud Khalil? That's what the administration has tried its best to portray me as, someone who's violent. Mahmoud Khalil is a human rights defender. Mahmoud Khalil is a freedom fighter. Mahmoud Khalil is a refugee. Mahmoud Khalil is a father and husband. And above all, Mahmoud Khalil is Palestinian. Mahmoud Khalil is a Palestinian who refused to remain silent while watching a genocide in Palestine.
He goes on to indict Colombia as helping in that effort. Good for him.
Unbelievable courage.
Yep.
And I would just go back and read some of the letters that he sent while he was detained, because those are going to be taught in colleges. Same way MLK's were.
Really impressive stuff. All right, couple IMs, and then we're getting out of here. We did not take any phone calls, and nobody was holding. Jackie IC, for accuracy, up-to-date news, follow the AI... IAEA and the United Nations for the latest. This morning, the statement of the Security Council by Rafael Mariano Grossi, Director General, International Atomic Energy Agency, on threats to international peace and security. We must return to the negotiating table and allow the IAEA inspectors, the guardians of the NPT, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, to go back to Iranian nuclear sites and account for the stockpiles of uranium, including, and most importantly, the 400... kilograms of enriched to 60%. Summer and American. I can't believe that it actually happened. Vermont Ben. I think the big bill, the Iran strikes, the ICE expansion, are symptoms of the same problem. Despite unpopularity of these policies, American politicians have no impetus to react to voters and will do just whatever they want. JJ, Brazil has a space program. Should we be bombing them next? Penny in New Mexico, MR listeners, you can help phone bank for Zoran from anywhere. Sign up at his website. Lavender allergy. If Trump commits to regime change, there is a non-zero chance he tries to install Patrick Bet-David as the Shah. Joe Snuffy. The U.S. is so deindustrialized, we can't even manufacture our own consent anymore. Limp Cheney, pronounced Lynn. Can you give us a deep dive into the underperformance of your AC? I need to get a new control panel, I think. Whatever. habeas your corpses. Reza Pavlov's campaign is an extremely online one, and now it's becoming more real. I think we need to talk about Cy Hirsch again. Don't know why you keep saying he doesn't have a good record. Yeah, he was right about this.
I mean, because he does have some misses, but he also... I mean, he's one of the most interestingly sourced guys probably to be a journalist in the past half century, just because of the type of sources he gets.
Al Jazeera is reporting explosions and flares in Qatar, yes. Tony from NOLA. Crazy to me that the Black Panthers were a socialist group, but so many black people don't want a socialist.
I mean, because that part of it is muted from the retelling often.
Harry from Munich. For a long time, I thought the ubiquity of look at 1938 appeasement never works commentary, regardless if it fit, was because most people don't know that more than one historical analogy. With strikes on Iran, I realized politicians in the West say that it's projection because it never works with us. There's an infinite series of farces. We have moved from farce to a farce of a farce, farce squared, farce cubed will be next, and so on. All right, five more. Glass Siegel. It's so disheartening that many Democrats and virtually everyone on TV support war with Iran. Can someone please give these people a nuke? Yeah, I understand your sentiment.
I like Ro Khanna saying that exact same thing. It shouldn't be hard to get more than 30-odd Democrats to sign on to something that, you know, again, and they don't even really have a problem except that they weren't briefed before, like says Adam Schiff.
Jazz Apple. ICE was chased out of Beacon, upstate New York, attempting to round people up. Sheer numbers of people got in their face and abandoned the operation. It's happening in Kingston, too, where I live. We're going to reach a breaking point with these shitbags, and I'm ready to go. Oh, I would love to see video of that. There was another place in California I saw some, just a very brief clip of that, too. They literally drove them out of town on the street. If any folks see any of this stuff, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com.
Yep.
Truly flops. Can't Trump argue that he has a right to do strikes under Article 2 for kinetic strikes, similar to Obama's use of drones? I'm not excusing any of this, but can he use it to justify the act? I, you know, he may not feel like he needs to. And Congress needs to step up. That's the bottom line. Boosh. Hey, Sam, can I get a shofar for my wife who successfully defended her PhD? Yes, you can. Thanks. And that discussed. Congratulations, wife. Jay Tingle. Why do they have the space project? Iran does not have the same rights as our billionaire super geniuses. All right, two more. 502 Drew, did little Marco just pull out the "I know you are, but what am I" defense? Can't beat that argument. And the final I am of the day. John Crane, what's going on with your YouTube feed? It plays about 10 or 15 minutes, then starts buffering. I like watching on YouTube. It gives the full experience. Okay.
I haven't seen that.
I'm going to read another one. That sounds like your Wi-Fi. And the final I am of the day. I just want to make it clear. There is nothing that we would be doing that would impact buffering on your computer. Just in no scenario.
And yeah, check if the chat is making the same complaint, because they're not.
Final I am of the day, Goose. 25 years in the Middle East. Isn't Vance missing a decade or so? Folks, Matt, Brian, good job today. Emma, hope you're enjoying your honeymoon. See you tomorrow.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the Mets are gonna kick in. And my pilot light's shining bright. I guess I'm where the choice is made.